Welcome to Expanding Your Faith, a podcast hosted by Bishop Greer Godsey of the Old Catholic Churches International. Expanding Your Faith brings together a panel of well-educated clergy and laity to discuss modern events with a biblical perspective. Our podcast is about to start. Please stay tuned. Everyone, and welcome to Expanding Your Faith. I'm Bishop Greer. Joining me tonight is Bishop Ben.
Greetings, everybody.
Reverend Mark is off on an exciting adventure tonight, so it's just the two of us. And tonight we're going to, I know we were supposed to talk about resurrection tonight, but since our podcast 2 weeks ago, because, you know, we had Holy Saturday or Great Easter Vigil last Saturday that preempted our podcast. So since 2 weeks ago, the world lost a remarkable and holy man, Pope Francis. His Holiness passed away this past Monday of a stroke, a rather massive catastrophic stroke. And irreversible heart attack. This morning, early in the morning here, U.S. time, 4 a.m. U.S. time, 10 a.m. Rome time, they had Pope Francis' funeral. And I stayed up to watch it just so we could comment on it and talk about it and talk about what's coming next for those that maybe you're Roman Catholic and have never gone through this before. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe you haven't gone through this, although I'm sure there's some teenagers who might listen that don't recall because they were too young the last time since. Pope Francis had been Pope for 12 years, so the last time we had a conclave was 12 years ago, so it, you know, might not be fresh in people's minds. And then, and for those that are Protestant that have no idea what the heck all this cardinal stuff's about, it's not little red birds, although they do like to dress in red. It's a rank within the Roman Catholic Church, and we'll kind of get into some of that too tonight. I will say that I was rather shocked by the Pope's sudden demise. We had just watched him Sunday, Easter Sunday, give his Ubi et Ori blessing from the Vatican balcony from St. Peter's Square, the balcony overlooking St. Peter's Square. And then ride around in the Popemobile in the crowd, blessing people and waving, and seemed to be in fairly good spirits, although he was visibly weaker than we had seen him in a while. He did manage to at least ride around for a little while. We found out in the days that followed that it was pretty obvious that Francis knew that he was not going to be around much longer. He made the comment to his nurse, who had been by his side and taken care of him for years. He asked, "Do you think that we can, you know, do this in St. Peter's Square one more time?" And before they loaded him up on the Popemobile. So, you know, little hints that he probably knew it was his last time to venture around the square. But most of the Roman Catholic world is in mourning. still for the loss of Pope Francis. There are some that sadly are celebrating it within the Roman Catholic Church, mostly trad Caths, traditional Catholics, who believe that the church was at its peak in about the 1400s. And Protestants, who are very happy to see what they view as the Antichrist die. So we'll talk a little bit about that too tonight. Bishop Ben and I both have sadly had to battle the forces of hatred and bigotry online this week. People who have taken it upon themselves to be judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to Pope Francis and his legacy. Even going so far as, you know, people creating fake accounts on social media for various cardinals to, you know, spew all kinds of hate and bigotry under those cardinals' names. So why is it important? Well, there are about 1 billion Roman Catholics in the world. When you add in the Catholics not connected with the Roman Church, that number almost doubles. When you add in Orthodox and Old Catholics and Anglicans and Episcopalians and Lutherans and Methodists, that number almost doubles, if not more. But 1 billion Roman Catholics in the world, and the Pope is considered the head of the Roman Catholic Church, the Bishop of Rome, the Supreme Pontiff, the Vicar of Christ on Earth. He is the King of Vatican City. You know, there's a lot of different titles he holds, Defender of the Faith, you know. Things of that nature. And so this Pope, vastly different from Pope Benedict, who he replaced. You might know that Pope Benedict in 2013 abdicated, which means he stepped down as Pope, but not before making himself a cushy position that had never been in the church before, called Pope Emeritus.
Mm-hmm.
Which gave him the right to walk around in the white robes and still act like Pope without actually doing any work. And so up until his death in 2022, Pope Emeritus Benedict continued to, in some ways, divide the church, you know, because there were people who believed he was still the legitimate Pope, mostly traditionalist Catholics who worship the Latin Mass and not the Beatitudes, who believed that Benedict was still very much their Pope and still very much in charge of the Roman Church and the Vicar of Christ on Earth. They looked upon Pope Francis as an anti-Pope. But after his death in 2022, things got a little easier for Francis because there was no other choice but to adhere to Francis being the Pope. That or just declare that the See of Peter was sed vacantist, which means that the see was empty, there was no Pope. Which I'm sure some of the most radical of the trad Catholics held to that belief. Francis's tenure as Pope was marked with kind of a mixed bag, I would say. On the one hand, he was much more progressive than John Paul II, than John the 23rd, than even John Paul I. Way more progressive than Benedict the 16th. Probably the most progressive pope ever. I would say. But even in that, many more progressive Roman Catholics felt he didn't go far enough, especially when it came to things like women's ordination or LGBTQIA acceptance in the church. I think that he tried, but I don't think that he was able to do much because of the Benedict holdovers in the Curia. Now, the Curia is the government of the Vatican.
Right.
And they are supposed to be beholden to the Pope, and they are supposed to follow the Pope's lead and not contradict him and not cause scandal. Unfortunately, for the last several decades, the Curia has done everything they can to undermine the Pope, and quite publicly, too, many times. So Francis had to battle that. After he said, who am I to judge when it comes to LGBT individuals? The Curia was quick to release a statement saying that Pope Francis's statements in no way reflected a change in church doctrine. So that was the kind of things he was having to deal with. Bishop Ben?
Well, I was going to say, you know, I remember when that statement was put out by the Curia. I remember shortly after that, they retracted it. I made a retraction, but I don't remember exactly what they retracted it to. But I do remember seeing a retraction. But on the same token, we have to look at today's time right now and see, we got to call into mind what the current cardinals are doing now and what the things are putting on now.
Right.
And I read an interesting commentary from Cardinal Donato here in Houston, where he's the former Archbishop of Houston, Galveston Diocese. Mm-hmm. He quoted in the Chronicle newspaper, he was quoted by one of the reporters saying that Pope Francis was like a symphony, a sonata. He was a mixture of different things. And the end quote was, Pope Francis was had a legacy that we should not forget. But he quoted Pope Francis in saying this thing, we should be messy Christians. Make a mess, but just make it work. It means a lot to what he said.
Right. Right. I wanted to point out, too, in Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re's homily at Pope Francis's funeral, there were a couple of lines that were very very enlightening or very telling about Pope Francis's time on earth. One of those was Cardinal Baptiste Ray said, despite his frailty and suffering towards the end, Pope Francis chose to follow the path of self-giving until the last day of his earthly life. He followed in the footsteps of his Lord, the Good Shepherd, who loved his sheep to the point of giving his life for them. And he did so with strength and serenity, close to his flock, the Church of God, mindful of the words Jesus quoted by the Apostle Paul, is more blessed to give than to receive. You know, that's a very telling testament to Pope Francis and his beliefs and how he viewed the papacy, you know.
Right.
And, you know, he said, continuing with Cardinal Baptiste Ray's sermon, he says, he had a great spontaneity and an informal way of addressing everyone, even those far from the church, rich in human warmth and deeply sensitive to today's challenges. Pope Francis truly shared the anxieties, sufferings, and hopes of this time of globalism. He gave himself by comforting and encouraging us with a message capable of reaching people's hearts in a direct and immediate way. His charisma of welcoming and listening, combined with a manner of behavior in keeping with today's sensitivities, touched hearts and sought to reawaken moral and spiritual sensibilities. Continuing, the guiding thread of his mission was also the conviction that the church is a home for all, a home with its doors always open. He often used the image of the church as a field hospital after a battle in which many were wounded, a church determined to take care of the problems of people and the great anxieties that tear the contemporary world apart, a church capable of bending down to every person, regardless of their beliefs or condition, and healing their wounds. His gestures and exhortations in favor of refugees and displaced persons are countless. His insistence on working on the behalf of the poor was consistent. He also pointed out in his homily, that faced with raging wars of recent years, with their inhumane horror and countless deaths and destruction, Pope Francis insistently raised his voice imploring peace and calling for reason and honest negotiation to find possible solutions. War, he said, results in the death of people and the destruction of homes, hospitals, and schools. War always leaves the world worse than it was before. It is always a painful and tragic defeat for everyone. Build bridges, not walls, was an exhortation he repeated many times. In his service of faith as successor of the Apostle Peter, also always was linked to the service of humanity in all its dimensions. So it's important that we take from this message of Cardinal Baptiste Ray in his homily at Pope Francis's funeral, this call to continue the mission of Pope Francis, continue building bridges and not walls. And it's also interesting that Cardinal Baptiste Ray made these comments with leaders that Pope Francis had harshly disagree with, like French President Macron, President Donald Trump of the United States, and others who routinely marginalized those that were immigrants and refugees. And he made it very clear, even with them sitting there, that call is still very much, a call should still very much be a part of the heart of the church. Right. The church should continue that mission of reaching all people, especially those marginalized, especially the immigrant, especially the refugee, and the poor and the homeless. I thought it was also telling that, there was the huge procession through Rome after the funeral because Pope Francis wanted to be buried in the Basilica of St. Mary Major there in Rome, which is about a few miles from the Vatican City. But it was one of the major basilicas in Rome, one of several. And he was very devoted to an icon there, the Blessed Mother. And so he wanted to be buried there in a very simple tomb. The tomb just reads his name, Franciscus, rather than having, his papal name and right. All of that stuff that's normally on the tomb. And hanging above it is a larger replica of his pectoral cross, the cross of the Good Shepherd, and that he had from when he was first ordained or first consecrated a bishop. He was then made an archbishop. He continued using it, and cardinal, and then pope. And as pope, he continued using that same pectoral cross as his papal cross. And so, but I think it was very interesting because the people that greeted him at St. Mary Major, the Basilica of St. Mary Major, were not rich aristocrats. It was not, world leaders. The people who greeted his coffin at the doors of St. Mary Major were the poor and homeless who gather in the portico in front of the basilica, who he would routinely go and help feed and take care of. And transgender women were there in great number. The same transgender women that he had washed their feet a few years ago at Holy Thursday Mass. It caused a huge scandal in the church because, up until then, the washing of feet on Holy Thursday was reserved to men only. Men were only the only ones allowed to have their feet washed for Holy Thursday. And the Pope broke with that in having transgender individuals make up the entirety of the 12 sit-ins for the disciples, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. And then, of course, this year for Holy Thursday, he visited a women's prison in Rome and assisted in washing the feet of the women prisoners, which was a huge departure from Catholic tradition. And those women, those cisgender women, transgender women, rather, and transgender men met him at the doors of the Basilica of St. Mary Major to welcome him to his final home. There at the Basilica, along with the poor and homeless he had served for the last 12 years as Pope in Rome, by going out in the middle of the night, sneaking out in his little Fiat,
right,
to go to soup kitchens and homeless shelters, dressed just as a priest, not in his papal garb, but as a priest, to go and to spend time with them, to feed them, to listen to them, to care for them. And those were the people, his people, as he called them, that welcomed him to his final resting place.
Right. Hence why they call him the people's Pope. But I also remember one comment he made, and this was early on in his papacy, during the time he got elected. He went and paid for his own hotel bill. But I remember the comment he made was, "If I didn't have to wear the papal regalia, I wouldn't."
Right.
He said he would choose a black cassock.
And we saw that when he came out on that balcony for the first time after they read the papal proclamation, "Habemus Papam," we have a pope. And they announced that it was Jorge Cardinal Bergoglio of Argentina. And that he had chosen the name Francis.
Right, and he had one comment.
And he came out.
What is that?
He came out just dressed in the papal cassock.
Right.
He was not wearing the
Mozzetta, whatever.
The Mozzetta. He was not wearing the elaborate stole, the gold and red stole. He wasn't wearing the red shoes. He came out in just the white cassock with his pectoral cross of the Good Shepherd around his neck, to wave at the people, to welcome the people. And his statement as he got ready to walk away was, "Pray for me. Pray for me. I will pray for you."
Right.
And, that really was very impactful because it was showing that he was shedding a lot of that elaborate tapestry, a lot of that elaborate regalia to be just a regular person, to be a pope of the people. And to be honest, I expected during the funeral, like we heard at John Paul II's funeral, there were people that were screaming from the crowd. The whole crowd roared in St. Peter's Basilica at the end of the papal funeral mass. They were getting ready to move him into the Vatican, to bury him in the catacombs under the Vatican. The people started chanting, "Santo Subio, Santo Subio."
Right.
Saint now. And I almost expected that As I watched it this morning, I almost expected the crowd to start chanting Santa Subio for Francis.
Wasn't there a reporter that made a mistake and called him St. Francis?
Yes, so Anderson Cooper, who I absolutely love, and who is a Roman Catholic, his family is Catholic. He was supposed to say that they were about to bring the coffin of Pope Francis out into St. Peter's Square. This was right before the funeral started, and instead he said, "They're about to bring the coffin of St. Francis out into Pope Peter's Square."
Right.
And and so I posted on social media and I said, since it's been said, so shall it be done, you know.
Right.
So let it be written, you know.
See, I agree with that. And I wish that there was an expedient process for the Vatican that could expedite making him a saint. Because I think that there's a lot of things that makes him a saint now.
Oh, certainly.
In my opinion.
Absolutely. And he was such a wonderful man and had such a heart for the people, you know, and for the least and the lost and the lonely and the forgotten. And I think that that's very saint qualities in the Pope. I want to pivot a little bit as our time is beginning to move along here a little more quickly than I thought it would. and talk about what comes next. You know,
right.
We buried the Pope this morning. For those that stayed up and watched it, or those who had the opportunity to be there, it was a very moving ceremony, very touching. You know, people, I'm sure, have been filing past his tomb all day as part of their pilgrimage in Rome. But what happens now? You know, we know that there has to be selected a new pope. So what's the process? And what a lot of people don't know is that the day that Pope Francis died, every head of a dicastery, every head of an office in the Curia submitted their resignation to the Camerlingo. Now, the Camerlingo is the guy who, first off, his first job is to confirm that the Pope has died by hitting him in the head with a little golden hammer.
Mallet.
It's not very big, and he doesn't hit him hard, so it's not like he's bludgeoning him to death. Although I'm sure there were some popes that, you know, they seriously considered it, but they hit him in the head three times and then they say to him, Jorge Bergoglio. And they wait a few seconds, and he doesn't respond. They hit him three more times in the head, and they say, Jorge Bergoglio, which is his birth name.
Right.
And if he doesn't respond after a few seconds, they hit him again three times. Jorge Bergoglio. And if he doesn't answer, then the Camerlingo turns to the cardinals assembled in the room and say, the Pope has died, in Latin.
Right.
The Pope has died. And at that time, they take his ring off his finger, the papal ring, and they smash it. They destroy it. And then begins the elaborate process of preparing his body for burial, for viewing and for burial and everything. And so that is that part of the process. The Camerlingo also oversees all the preparations for the conclave. And the conclave is where they elect the next pope. So, the rules are pretty simple for the most part. Any cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church under the age of 80 is allowed to vote in the conclave and allowed to participate in the conclave. If they're over 80, they can be at the Vatican. They cannot go into the conclave, but they can be there and they can talk with the Cardinals on their breaks and stuff like that. But they're not allowed to be inside the Sistine Chapel during the sessions of the conclave. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is after all of the cardinals have submitted their resignation the day the Pope dies, the Camerlingo is officially the only person with a job in the Curia. There's no other people in charge of the Curia except for the Camerlingo. By the same token, everything grinds to a halt except for the normal day-to-day operations of the church. No decisions can be made on faith or doctrine or any of that kind of stuff. No major decisions on removing bishops, appointing bishops, cardinals, and that kind of thing. Nothing like that can be done until a new pope is selected. But the cardinals have been meeting since the day after Pope Francis died. They met every day in the morning at about 9 a.m., for these plenary sessions, essentially, where the cardinals came together to decide when the Pope's funeral was going to be, how long he was going to lie in state, whether they were going to honor his wishes about being embalmed, whether they were going to honor his wishes about the casket and burial and blah, 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 blah. As of Friday, the last plenary session for this week, the discussion was, when will we start the conclave?
Conclave.
And the conclave is now slated to begin on May 5th. So all of the cardinals around the world who are under the age of 80 will travel to the Vatican unless they have a significant reason not to. And they will go through this long, elaborate process. When they first arrive, they have to give up their phones and computers and tablets and all that stuff. They are allowed no electronic devices through the duration of the conclave. They then gather on the day of the start of the conclave and perform an elaborate ritual where they go into the Sistine Chapel. They have Mass together for the first time. They swear their oath at the conclave that they will keep secret everything that happens inside the conclave, that they will not share what happens with anyone. And then usually they take a break for lunch. Now, in the case of Benedict and Francis's conclaves, they had Mass and then they held their first vote and then they had lunch. That is an option. They can do that. Who knows what will happen this time. After lunch, they'll come back together and begin their voting. They will hold as many as 2 votes per day until they elect a pope. And they have to have 75% of the cardinals agree upon a candidate. It's done by secret ballot. They're given little scraps of paper, and on it it says, "I choose," in Latin, and then there's a blank. And they write in the name of who they think should be pope. And they fold that piece of paper up, and they go up to this large chalice sitting on the altar of the Sistine Chapel. On top of it is a plate, a paten. And they put their slip on top of the paten. Well, they hold it up first, and they say, you know, "I freely cast my vote for this candidate," blah, 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 blah. And then they put it on the paten, and then they take the paten and they dump it into the chalice. After all the cardinals have done this ritual, then there are 3 cardinals who are in charge of counting the votes. And they will then begin pulling these cards out of the chalice and read them off. using the previous conclave as an example, one vote for Cardinal Bergoglio. Hands it to the next cardinal, who looks at it and goes, one vote for Cardinal Bergoglio. He marks it down on his piece of paper, and then he hands it to the third cardinal, who looks at it and goes, one vote for Cardinal Bergoglio. And he sticks a needle with a piece of thread on it through the card and pulls it to the end. And then the first cardinal takes the next sheet. One vote for Cardinal Serra. Passes it to the next guy. One vote for Cardinal Serra. He marks it down on his piece of paper under Cardinal Serra. Then they hand it off to the next one, who does it again. One vote for Cardinal Serra. Puts the needle through the paper and slides it to the end. If no one gets the requisite 90 votes, then they gather up all those cards on that piece, on that string. And they put it into the stove, the fire stove, to burn, along with some black soot type stuff that makes it appear more black when the smoke comes out. If it's black smoke, there is no pope chosen. If a candidate gets 90 votes in this particular conclave, it's 90 votes. Then they'll put all of those cards into the stove with a mixture that causes white smoke. And white smoke will appear out the chimney above the Vatican. Now, good question, Nate. Nate says, what happens if the cardinals can't come to a decision via this method? They hold two votes a day for at least 10 days. If they are not able to come up with a person for 90 votes by the end of 10 days, updated canon law put in place by John Paul II allows them to vote to go to the simplified method. And the simplified method is 50% plus one. And they then take their votes, and if they have someone who gets 50% of the cardinals plus one, which would be, see, it's 130, that's 65, 66.
Plus one, yeah.
66 is the plus one, so 66 votes for a particular cardinal. Then they just continue voting indefinitely until they get to 66. Two votes a day. They can do as much as four votes a day after that 10 days to help expedite the process. Since the 1700s, I think it was, there has not been a conclave that has lasted much past a month or so at the longest. The longest conclave to ever happen was in like 1750s. And it lasted 3 years.
I remember that.
They finally ripped the roof off the Sistine Chapel to force them to vote for a candidate to pick a pope. Hopefully we won't have the repeat of that. That was the whole reason for having the simplified rules after 10 days, was to avoid the potential for that kind of thing happening again. But I mean, anything's possible, right? You know.
Right, and what a lot of people don't know too is, during the setup of the Sistine Chapel, there's a lot of nuances that go into that, like setting up platforms, chairs, and desks. And also, people don't know that the stove that's in the Sistine Chapel is not there year round. It's only installed during the conclave.
That is correct.
It's amazing on what the process is that goes into a conclave, like. They do every morning. They do bug sweeps, camera sweeps. They do a lot of security stuff just to keep it maintained for the security reasons.
And this week, starting probably Monday, it usually starts about a week before the conclave. The Sistine Chapel will be closed to visitors.
Right.
Now, it's the only time the Sistine Chapel is really, truly closed to visitors is during the conclave. But they will close it a week before the conclave so that the maintenance crews and stuff, there are huge glass windows around the top of the Sistine Chapel to let light in. Because there wasn't electricity back when the Sistine Chapel was first built.
Right.
So you had to have lighting somehow. And so they put these huge metal panels over the windows. And the reason they do that, they started that in 2005 for the conclave of John Paul II. The reason they do that is because the Swiss Guard were afraid that with the new technology such as, you know, laser hearing devices, you know, where you shine the laser against glass and it picks up the vibrations and you can hear what's being said.
Right.
They were afraid that news media and curious onlookers would use those to listen into the conclave. So they... the Pope ordered these huge metal panels to be put over the glass windows so that that kind of technology couldn't be used to hear what was going on inside the conclave. And as Bishop Ben said, every morning the entire chapel is sweeped for bugs, for camera devices. Every cardinal is searched before they enter the Sistine Chapel. Once they're locked in the Sistine Chapel, their baggage is searched, their person is searched, make sure they don't have any recording devices, no electronics, no computers, no phones, no tablets, nothing. And once they're locked in the Sistine Chapel, there's a special hallway that takes them back to the Casa de Santa Marta, which is where they stay, the conclave. And they will not have access to the outside world until the conclave is over. So they come in contact with no one from the outside world during that time. The nuns that served them food at Santa Marta are bound to secrecy. They're bound to not speak to the cardinals about what's going on in the world, to not speak to them about their thoughts about the conclave or anything. They're just to serve them food in silence, and that's it. So everything is done to kind of protect the process, to make sure that there's no outside influence to the process. And there have been times where there have been attempts to disturb the conclave. There were bomb threats several times throughout history against the conclave. And had the cardinals known that this was going on, they might have taken it out on the cardinal from whatever country or group of people were doing that. And so they chose, you know, that they couldn't know. They were not allowed to know what was going on in the outside world so that the process could not be tampered with. The cardinals could not be influenced. So that's going to start not this coming Monday, but the following Monday, May 5th. And they'll begin the conclave then. I suspect it will not be a long conclave. I suspect it will probably be a few days, maybe a week at most. I think most cardinals walked away from the funeral today with a good idea of the kind of person they're looking for. Maybe not, I know exactly who I'm voting for, but at least they came away with some idea of who they were looking for, what kind of cardinal they were looking for. And so now we'll begin a process over the next week of them kind of praying and thinking about, you know, what qualities they want in the next pope. And then when they meet on May 5th, they'll begin hammering out those ideas as a group. talk for just a minute, Bishop Ben, about the rules about politicking in the conclave?
Well, the far as the way I understood it when I was in seminary school, we were explained that they can't, they're not supposed to be doing any politicking, they're not supposed to do any like fundraising. They can't accept any money for positions. They cannot discuss with any of the people who they're going to be voting for, who likely to vote for, all that. So it's not supposed to go on, but, you know, sometimes I'm sure that pretty happens.
Oh, I'm sure it's happened throughout history, yes.
Right, right.
And they're not supposed to do any quid pro quos, you know.
Right.
Oh, I will make you my Camerlingo if you vote for me.
Right, promising positions.
I'm sure it's happened, okay? We had people like Pope Innocent, who was not innocent at all, who was a very evil pope, the right. Borgia pope. And so I'm sure some of that happened in his day and time.
And, you know, it makes you wonder, in that process, really, how much politicking does go on before the conclave? Mm-hmm. And it makes you wonder, too, because you were not in that process, you know, it makes you wonder what the nuns actually see and hear when they're actually serving dinner, lunch, and breakfast to them.
Sure.
You know, because there's bound to be some kind of communication in that hall.
Oh, I'm sure they talk over dinner and stuff with each other, right, about, you know, what they want to see and,
right,
you know,
direction of the church. And
of course, they all know the counts. I mean, you know, once all the votes are tallied, the dean of the College of Cardinals stands up, the dean of the conclave stands up and reads off a tally. Bergoglio got 62 votes, right. Sarah got 53, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so they all know the direction everyone's voting in. They may not know who's voting, but they know that the majority of people are voting for this candidate. And
right.
The first vote, a lot of cardinals who've not been, you know, terribly faithful to their vows of secrecy have let us know over the years that the first vote of the conclave, I keep wanting to call it a synod, the conclave, the first right. vote of the conclave, typically, just about all the cardinals vote for themselves.
Right, right. It's like a throwaway vote. Kind
right.
of.
They just get that out of the way. Let's just get that out of the way. Okay. And so, you know, there'll very rarely be Pope chosen on the first ballot. And so they do that. And then the second ballot, you begin to notice kind of the trend that's forming, you know. The alliances where, you know, you have this cardinal's got so many votes and that cardinal's got so many. It kind of narrows down to like five or six cardinals that kind of have the votes.
You know, Nate has a good question here, and I wouldn't even know the answer to that, to be honest.
Nate says, what happens if a cardinal is found to be trying to swing the vote? Well, canon law is pretty clear. The punishment for that is rather severe. They can lose their position in the church altogether. They can be removed from the priesthood if it's considered to be egregious enough, which means that they would no longer, they'd be a layperson again. Or they can be allowed to remain a cardinal, but have their right to vote in the conclave revoked. And they can have their right to be a candidate in the conclave revoked. So it just kind of depends on how egregious it is trying to swing the vote as right. to whether or not what kind of punishment happens. Melissa says, so what if it is rigged? Are we just to trust their word if there's no proof of it, like video or recording? And that's a good point. At a certain point, you do just have to kind of trust that they're going to hold to their oath and hold to the process. We do know, because of history, that there were unscrupulous people who rigged the process. who blackmailed other cardinals to get them to vote their way. Borgia popes are a good example of that. Who did quid pro quos. But the rules for the conclave have also gotten more strict since then. And so all it takes is for one cardinal to say, I think you're trying to rig the vote. And they now have to investigate that. And investigate it rather heavily. And the punishments can be quite severe. So it has cut back a lot of that attempt to rig it. Now, that's not to say that outside of the College of Cardinals, world leaders, politicians, dignitaries don't try to rig it to favor their particular ideology on a world stage, which we've also seen in history where the Roman Emperor tried to sway bishops and cardinals, or cardinals rather, to vote a certain way
right.
for a certain person. There's not been any known instances of that in the last several hundred years, but I wouldn't put it past someone like Russia or China or even the United States under our current regime to try to sway the vote, to rig the papal election to get a more conservative pope so that there's not this world religious leader out there like Francis was doing, saying, no, you can't keep treating immigrants this way. No, you can't send them to concentration camps. You have to take care of the refugee and the immigrant among you. You have to not throw out LGBT individuals, but you have to love and support them. So I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't world leaders trying to find a way to rig it. The good part of that is that cardinals are not beholden to world leaders anymore. So they are only beholden to the Vatican. So because of that, the concern is more about, I don't want to get thrown out of the church, versus the president of the United States is going to, you know, send me to El Salvador to prison. You know,
right.
If I don't vote the way he wants me to. And because the church is more global, we talked about this early in the podcast, the church is far more global than it used to be, with cardinals in places there weren't cardinals ever before.
Right.
Like Congo. And
what was it? Pope Francis made, what, 102 popes?
He made 102 popes, or 102 yeah. cardinals out of the cardinals, 130 yeah. that are voting. 102 of them he made cardinals.
Right.
So that's a two-edged sword in a way, because in one way, by making cardinals in parts of the world that have never had cardinals, like Oceania, and more in Asia, more in Africa, the church is far more global, so it's a lot harder for a world leader to influence the outcome, because there's not 90 cardinals from any one country or continent. On top of that, because he did appoint 102, and they only need 90 of them to... he appointed 102 out of 130, and they only need 90 to elect someone. The chances of getting a moderate to a progressive pope is exponentially higher because of that. Because right. he appointed cardinals that were more in line with his thinking. The church should be a poor church. That it should be a church that takes care of the poor and the homeless, that reaches out to transgender and LGBT individuals and doesn't condemn them for who they are. That allows divorced people to go to communion and participate fully in the life of the church. So because of that, we are more likely to see a moderate to progressive pope. We're going to do these last two questions real quick as we wrap up here. Melissa says, so Bishop and Bishop Ben, have the two of you ever thought about being pope? You go first, Bishop Ben.
Actually, no. And you know, the thing is, like Pope Francis says, if you want to be Pope, you don't love yourself. And we in the Old Catholic Church have a saying that if you want to be a bishop, then you don't belong being a bishop. Nobody, I know for my fact that I didn't strive to be a bishop, or I sure as heck don't want to be a pope neither. You can see what kind of toll it took on him to be pope.
Right. Well, I will say I want to be pope just to be able to ride around the Pope Mobile. I could be pope one day and then I'll resign. Right. I just want to ride around the Pope Mobile. No, I honestly have no desire to be pope. Being a presiding bishop is hard enough.
Right.
I don't think that my health could handle being a pope. Nor would I want that headache. Nate says, does the pope have to be Roman Catholic, or does that not matter as much? No, they have to be Roman Catholic. Any Roman Catholic male who is unmaried is eligible to be what's called papable, meaning they can be elected to be pope. So they don't have to choose a cardinal. They could choose a layperson or a priest or a deacon, or, you know, the only stipulation is that before they take the papal throne for their coronation or installation, depending on which one they choose to do, they do have to be ordained and consecrated as a bishop. So ordained as a deacon and priest and consecrated as a bishop. But they could choose a layperson, and they've done it before in the history of the church. We had a 14-year-old pope years ago.
Right.
I want to say in the 1000s, 1100s. There was a 14-year-old pope. He was definitely not a deacon, priest, or bishop before he was elected. So, yeah, it could happen, but they do have to be Roman Catholic, they do have to be male, and they do have to be unmarried. They have to be celibate. So that's a good question, Nate. Thank you. Well, we've run out of time. We're not going to do a final thought tonight. I don't really think we need one, honestly, on this topic.
Nope.
But I do ask that if you're a praying person, do pray for our brothers and sisters in the Roman Catholic Church during their time of grief and during their time of choosing the next pope. Please pray that it's someone that is more moderate or not conservative, more moderate or progressive, not a conservative.
Please.
So that the church can continue moving forward rather than going backward. And I do pray for all those affected by the death of Pope Francis, because he touched so many lives. So next week, here on Expanding Your Faith, we're going to talk about resurrection and what it means to us. Kind of move that topic a week since all of this happened during our break. Thank you, Bishop Ben, for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me, as always. I greatly appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. And until we once again attempt to expand your faith, keep shining bright, my friends. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Expanding Your Faith. For more information on Expanding Your Faith, check us out on facebook.com/expandingyourfaith. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you find your podcasts. Until next week, when we once again attempt to expand your faith, keep shining bright.